day with Matinee Lautner, which will be our guest for this chapter. We also recorded it in Hebrew, so it's 10A or 10B as you would like to call it. But for our audience in English, we have decided to record also in English. So Matanel has traveled, volunteered, and learned in India for around a year. He graduated in the Hebrew University, studying for his first degree in comparative religion in the ASEAN Religion Department, and he's starting his master's in the same topic. During his traveling, he visited in Manipur for 3 times. The last one was in last October. So you were there, but before all the ethnic conflict has started.
Yes.
So what besides before we get started, what was your impression from this region in Manipur, one of the 7 states in the northeast of India?
So my first times were 2019, and first time I felt that it's something quite different than what we call mainland India, the more central parts of India. And the first thing I understood is when I went on the bus getting towards Imphal from the area of Nagaland, the bus was stopped for several times, and the bus driver was supposed to pay money, and I assuming he just had to pay to some militias that were operating already there and trying to gain money. I don't know for what reasons. Maybe, as we know, maybe it's connected to weapons or all kinds of gathering force. And I felt it's something very different. I felt some kind of tense in the air. And actually, my last visiting was quite short, and I was visiting in a specific group of part of the cookie group that hosted me. So I didn't really get to see the different opinions and feel, I don't know, walking the roads of Imphal and feel what's the feeling of the people. But when I visited in 2019, there was another thing going there. And there was some kind of unrest. I was in a hotel in Imphal, and there was some kind of attack, and even a policeman died in an explode that was
Wow.
a kilometer from the hotel. So in this area, everything can happen in an amount of days. Even stable situations can deteriorate in days, weeks, and months, and become like hell, as we saw that happened in Manipur just a few months ago.
So, yes, yeah, so we give a bit of background. So Manipur, it's in the northeast of India, and it is suffering about like 3 months or maybe 4 months of ethnic conflict, which caused for the death of at least 150 people. And the last news or the last news that went viral around the world was a short movie of two women that was forced to go naked in a mob and then was raped by the Métis tribe, a few months of them. And it was a long time ago, but only now the video became viral, and it also forced the Narendra Modi, which was really silent in all this time of the conflict, to go for the press and to condemn this incident. So for start, there is like a really a violent and bloody a violent between the two main tribes from the Métis and the Kuki. Could you give us a bit background about this conflict?
So we could trace this conflict for decades. I mean, we're talking about two kinds of population. There's the more Hindu-oriented people, the Meitei, that live in the valley, in the Imphal Valley. And these people already adopted Hinduism maybe a few hundreds years ago, and or maybe more similar to what we consider as the mainstream Indian society, people that are more agriculture, that have a long history of kingdoms, of course, of text, of all of that kind of civilization. But the Imphal Valley is surrounded by hills, and in these hills we can find several tribes, the Naga tribes, or for this incident, the Kuki tribes. And these people are from completely different background, and these people live in the forest. And during the history, they didn't really have history as we assume it. They didn't have text. They didn't have kingdoms, and maybe they were part of kingdoms, but they didn't have kings of themselves, and were just living in the hills, using agriculture techniques for their livelihood. And there was some kind of let's say different lifestyles between these two populations. But as the Britishers came to that area, and afterwards it became part of the Indian Union, so these people were actually in putting together in the same state. And when you take two kind of societies and you put them together, yeah, it could create clashes, and it's not the first conflict.
Yes, you remember the ancient mistake, one of many of the English, which cut the border of countries between Burma, which today it's Myanmar, and between Burma, then that time in India, and like mixed population that did not live together. And now part of them were in India and part of them like stayed in Burma, part of their families and part of their tribes. So, I mean, this artificial way of establishing boundaries is certainly one of the reason for the clashes today. Are there beside the fact that those two population are not share the same history. Are you see like more roots for this conflict?
Of course. So basically, when the history is so different, so of course also reality, also the present, is quite different. The Meitei are basically more educated, have more connections. Look at the politicians. It's basically the state is run by mostly by the Meitei, that are actually 53% of the population, and while the Kukis are different. Basically, originally they come from a villager's background, and of course there's also a religious difference. While, as I said, a lot of Métis are actually Hindus, almost all of the Kukis basically are Christians. So there's also different in the religion background, different in lifestyle, and different in the geographic areas. And of course, there's competition for resources. Every group wants for themselves more, and will do a lot of things. Part are nice and legal, and part are not so nice, as we saw, to promote their group. And that's basically and the definition maybe of an ethnic conflict.
Yes, so we'll touch in few points that you said now, but let's start from the things of the resources. So the official reason for the conflict was the ruling of the court in the country, which gave the Métis also a state status of ST, which means that they can buy also lands in the hills. If we put a bit background, the Kuki lives most in the hills and the Métis in the valley in the Imphal, and they're although they are the majority in the country, they are not allowed to buy lands in the hills. So the court rules that they can also buy land up in the hills and also to get also an access to a lot of benefits that the cookie had. So this was the official that the cookie are feeling that they are taking some of the privilege that they need. And from the start, they are in like low point in the country from economic state. So what is your view on this subject? Do you really see that this is the reason for the conflict that outbreaks now?
For sure, it's part of the deal. As we mentioned, there is some historical background, but still, the historical background was there for a long time, and only now, actually, the clashes erupted. So, basically, as we know, in India, there is a lot of this kind of, you could call it caste politics. I don't know if it's exactly the right definition in this case, but basically, because according to the Indian law, there is a way to promote groups that were suffering from injustice for centuries. So basically, every kind of group is trying to say that there are the people that need the protection. They need the law to basically allow them to get more jobs, to reserve roles in academy, in government, in anything else, and the cookies were feeling that if they get this protection, so it could give them an option to advance their life. But if also the Meitei get this protection, so basically most of the population of the states enjoy this protection, and
So
therefore
it will
nobody
be,
may enjoy.
yeah, so it will be meaningless.
Yeah, and there were protesting against it, and I think it's a legitimate way to promote your group.
Yeah.
The only problem is that the violence started after that.
Yeah. So the cookies is, point that, this reason is the reason for the conflict. But I mean, there is a lot of layers for this conflict. You mentioned that the Kuki are Christian mostly, and the Métis are Hindus mostly. But there is, and also these things of the resources. But I mean, there is so much in it, like the illegal immigration from Myanmar, the illegal weapons, and the drug addiction in the village. So there is so much. The situation is so complicated that I'm not sure that one can say that. I mean, what is the real reason for the conflict between those two groups? Can you
Yeah.
like explain, because you've been there, you saw the village. Can you explain it more about the village and the way of life there?
Yeah, so you mentioned before the civil war. So 2019, I visited in the Myanmar side of
Yes.
the border in what's called Chin State or Tarim Mountains. And there I was hosted in villages that were quite similar to the Manipuri, to the Kuki people. They talk almost the same language, and they feel that they're part of a big ethnic group. And when civil war erupted in Myanmar, and we know there's conflicts that are between the main government and different ethnic groups in the Chin state and in other areas. So refugees from these groups are fleeing towards India, and the Kuki people are feeling that they have to host it. It's part of their family, their kinship. But for the Meitei, it's a big threat, because once the Kuki population grows, of course, we have more influence. So that's actually another reason for the tense. And regarding living in a village, so there's a big variety, I think. As we know today, in every village you have smartphones. It's not like, I don't know, 20 years ago, everyone knows about about these technologies, and every boy on this planet already has, every boy and girl has access to YouTube or TikTok or any other applications. But still, when you visit in a village that's in the mountain, the access to electricity is limited, the access to water, of course, transportation, and also education. What's a somebody that grows in this village, what he already knows is education is very limited, his perspective is very limited. And these are people that are, I think we could assume that they come from a very weak background, and they will find very difficult to struggle in cities or struggle in a competition that India or any other country in the Western world offers.
So you mentioned that the starting points are really low, and their access is, as you said, for education and for any basic infrastructure are really low. But in a way, I'm not sure that they are not comfortable with that situation. I'll put it in other words, they are really comfortable with the fact that the government or the local government has not has it forced on them. I mean, they cherish that freedom and that kind of autonomy to live their life as they want, with all the implication of that.
Of course, it's a very personal question. I think every individual and every community can give different answer for that question. But basically, we need to remember that things cannot stay as they used to during the history. If today someone wants to live over just cultivating rice in mountains, it's much more difficult than 100 years ago. And because life expenses are much higher, and people are, I think, moving towards a bigger, I don't know if call it cities, but maybe semi-cities. For example, I've been in the city of Chuanchanpur. Today it's called Langka. I think almost 100% of that town is cookies, people that originally lived in villages, but felt that they want to advantage their life. And we need to remember that once someone is already exposed to all the media, he sees people that are living in a much higher lifestyle, he probably will have a dream to improve his own lifestyle. And especially in times of crisis, where people see that even the small thing that happens to them can ruin their life. So they are looking for opportunity. They are looking for money and improve their lives. But as we know, the options are quite limited in all the region, I think, in all of Northeast India.
Yeah, it is definitely one of the neglected area in India. And which brings us to another point, this ethnic and violent conflict, which is from, I don't know, for May, I think it started, it's really been like, didn't get any from the main government any attention that we would expect. I mean, Amit Shah came to visit in the region, and also Modi gave statement after the viral video of the rape. But beside that, it seems that this conflict is under the bridge. I mean, like it's not causing any interest in the main government to do something, to act, which is quite surprising. How do you explain this relationship? I mean, although I have to mention that there is now a motion for confidence against Modi about this money pool, but still Modi is really putting it like it's not an issue for him. How's that?
Before I answer your question, so I
Yes.
just want to mention that actually we had our Hebrew episode, Shibrit, even before all the story with the viral video. So we were
Yes.
interested in this topic, and we're interested basically in all kinds of topics of India. We share our love to India.
Yes.
But actually, not only Modi, but all the public interest in India was not interested in the story. I mean, yeah, there were some reports, but it didn't attract, it didn't get into the mind of the average Indian. And I remember after the video became viral, I saw in the social media my friends from India were posting this story about Manipur, you know, the image of the Indian woman with all that all that story. And actually, once it became the interest of the public in India, so Modi had to actually come and say his word about it, and we all heard his word about this situation. And I think the key question is to ask why it didn't interest the average Indian. Why only after this terrible event happened, and as we know, many other terrible events happened, only this became viral. And I think the answer is we need to look on geographics. I mean, Manipur is so far from Delhi, it's so far from Bangalore, it's Mumbai, even from Kolkata. It took me, I think, 3 hours of a flight to get from Delhi to Manipur. And when I took it by train, it took me, and buses, it took me a few days to get there. So basically, we're talking about the fact that the average Indian never had visited in the northeast of India. And when one of my hosts in Manipur studied in Delhi University for his degree, people, educated people that are students in university, called him Chinese or Philippines or Thai, because even their face is different than the Indian typical face. And I think it just didn't interest because it was so far from anything else that happens in India, so far of the regular politics of the caste politics and you know, all the tense between Hindus and Islam. And there we have maybe an area that's dominated by Christians, there's more Buddhist. And I think it's some kind of for the typical Indian, it's some kind of alien culture, alien something that happens somewhere near China and Myanmar. And we had to have this terrible video to be published to basically attract the interest of the average Indian.
Still, I'm surprised because Manipur has border with China, with Myanmar, with Nepal, with Bhutan, with Bangladesh, and I don't want to mention all the conflict with China in the border, which is, I mean, from a strategic point, this country is really important in India terms. I was wondering, maybe the fact that this country and as other country in the Nordics like Netherlands has suffered from long history of violence, and that it's like in waves and which is going up and going down. Maybe the reason is that I don't know. Maybe they are hoping that it will be calm down from itself. I don't know what's the reason, but I'm trying to find a reason. Maybe they think because of the history of the violence of Manipur, they think it will end as it was in the a few times before that it just ended as it came.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe because there was such a history of violence there. I think we need to remember that around 3 million people live in Manipur. In terms of India, it's like, I
Nothing.
don't know. Yeah, maybe a big city or even average city. I'm not sure about the numbers, but basically, and in this 3 million, it concludes of so many different kinds of tribes and ethnic groups. So I think that there's just kind of misunderstanding of like maybe the typical Indian is saying to himself, okay, they could solve their problems for themselves. There are only 3 million people. We in Bangalore and Mumbai and Delhi have much more, and Kolkata have much more people, and we manage to solve our problems. But as we see, the groups there can't solve the problems by themselves. We see that violence erupted, and the center had to send new forces there, I think 40,000 forces to stop the violence, and still we're hearing that still violence still erupts in the region. It's not completely in peace and quiet right now.
So while the main government is I don't know, hoping for the violence to go away, or thinking the problem is too complicated to solve, in the meantime, the cookie is really forcing the idea that separation is the only way to get out of the situation, meaning they are hoping to get their own state or their own autonomy, and they keep mentioning the Telangana case, which I'm not sure it's the same, but they're really forcing for separation. Do you think it's a realistic solution or that could even happen this time under the Modi government?
The separation is an option on the table. You mentioned Telangana, of course, that's a recent case, but even in the history of that region, Mizoram was part of the bigger Manipur state until it was separated. And in Mizoram, there is the Mizo ethnic group that are living there, so it was quite easy to separate. Now it is an option, but still, I think it's much more complicated geographically. As I mentioned, the valley is circularized by the hills. So basically, the people of possibly new state of the Impole Valley, the Métis people, will have no access, not to Myanmar and not even towards the other states of India. So it still could cause some kind of tensions. And of course, as we know, a lot of people will need to move from one state to another because, as we know, populations in reality are mixed. It's not like all the natives are living in the valley and
Yes.
all of the cookies are living in the hills. And we also need to remember that the more agriculture rich areas or the valley, of course, so there could be tension, there could be problems, but still I can't say that we can't consider this option. I mean, meanwhile, we see that the ones that were violent, at least in the last clash, were the Métis, and I think they're feeling maybe they have nothing to lose; they could only gain something. And I think that if this option was on the table, they could actually feel that they have something to lose. They could split their state into two and lose most of the area. So, if it's an option, I think it will be much easier to get them into the table and start peace discussions between the groups. And whatever the solution is, it could promote the peace solutions and returning peace for that region.
Just to make sure, you're saying that the Métis are, you think, are more violent in this round of conflict?
Yeah, so basically, I think that also, of course, in the gun case, in the rape, the gun rape case, but even before that, basically, the people that took weapons to their hands and went to burn villages of other people were Métis doing it to the cookie. Again, I'm not saying that there's not history to this conflict.
But sorry to interrupt. As I seen, it's pretty mutual. I mean, the rapes, the burning of Hindu temples, the burning of churches, the burning of people. I mean, the killing were really, I don't know, from both sides. Did you impressed that it's more like a violent of the cookies against the making?
Really hard because, as we know, in ethnic conflicts, There's no righteous and evil people that you can easily define. Everyone has his own. You ask everyone from each side, and of course he will justice his own side and explain why his group were the righteous and the other were the evil. So we need, yeah, we need to actually look at it in a more critical attitude. But still, if we focus only on the last conflict, so basically the Kuki had their protests that were more or less peaceful protests, and then the Meitei took the guns, took the weapons to their hands, and went to burn and loot Kuki villages. Maybe it was because they had more access to their villages, maybe because the Imphal is the capital, so some of the Kuki people live in Imphal, but there's no reason for Meitei to live in the hills, so it was much easier to the Meitei to get advantage over the Kukis. Okay, so I'm not saying that there were not maybe good reasons why the Meitei were more violent, but I think that is the fact. At least in the last round, the Meitei were much more violent.
Well, I have to say that this is the narrative that I've seen, that I'm hearing and heard in the media. That this is the violence of the Métis against the Kuki, and it's under the narrative that Modi is leading like a Hindustan line, which wants to promote the Hinduism population and the Hinduism notions in the country. But at least, I don't know, I mean, I don't know how precise that, but from at least from YouTube videos that I saw, the violence, it's pretty, I don't know, equal as much as we can say. I mean, from testimony of people, I mean, it's really hard to judge. There's like videos which you can see, like Métis begging for the army not to leave their village, and like Métis, widow that's saying that their husband were killed by the Kukis, and also Métis that are with no guns. I don't know. I mean, it's really hard to judge, I think, to see who is, I mean, who is more violent in this round.
Yeah, I completely agree. Everyone is biased towards his side. You mentioned that Modi, that few people claim that it's what happened is part of Modi's policy towards promoting Hinduism. I think it's the wrong attitude. I think that I understand maybe an Indian is trying to understand what happened, so he takes maybe the regular narrative he knows already about mainland India and tries to apply it on this region. I don't think it's right. As we know, so the president of India is part of a tribal society. And besides that, I think that it wasn't, the violence wasn't part of some kind of policy of the center. I think it's just there. As we know, in different regions in the world, in Africa and in Southeast Asia and many other conflicts, Afghanistan, for instance, have a ethnic background, and I don't think it's different. I don't. Maybe the agencies and the players are different because, as we know, the center and Indian state and country have a lot of role on this conflict, but I don't think it's the right way to approach this conflict.
Yes, we also have to mention like the Jew point in this conflict, which is like a small, but there is a Jewish community which belongs to the Kuki tribe. Truly, really interesting what's in the Kuki tribes, and also when you told me that when you've been in Myanmar, you also saw like more developed even community of Jewish people in the other side of the border. So like it's really surprising that they are part of the Kukis, how they get there. I mean, I know there is like the story of the Ten Lost Tribe, but it's really interesting. So I like to hear about the things that you saw in this community and how they're trying to how did they are part even from the history of the place of the from the Kuki tribe.
Yeah, so that's a fascinating story. It started maybe 100 years ago when a guy actually is part of the Mizoram state of today, named Melchiorra. So in that time, the population was transferring themselves from more an animistic religion towards Christianity. The missionaries were at that time, and he had this dream where he was told by a ghost that he cannot work on Shabbat, on Saturday, the holy days for Jews. Didn't understand what's the meaning of that. Didn't have any kind of connection to Judaism at that time, of course. But still, he started a kind of sect, a stream that still in that time still combined between Jewish ideas and the belief in Jesus Christ. But then in the 70s, there was a branch that actually stopped to worship Jesus at all and stick towards Judaism. And when rabbis, Orthodox rabbis from Israel came there and got to see that community, so they introduced them with the Orthodox Jewish lifestyle, the traditional Jewish lifestyle. And from there and onwards, we could hear about communities both in Mizoram, both in Manipur, and even, as you mentioned, in Chin State in Myanmar, that are practicing Judaism. A few thousands of them already immigrated to Israel and in Israel joined the IDF and are part of Israeli society and are considered as Jews. And few thousands are still waiting in that area, as I mentioned before. And the people that we're talking about in Manipur, at least, are belonging to the Kuki community. And therefore, one of their villages was burned during the last violence, and they had to flee away. And today, they're rehabiting themselves in Chuanchanpur, in Lanka, and some of them fled even to Mizoram. And these people are still dreaming to immigrate one day to Israel.
Yes. About the Jewish community, what I hear from what you're saying, it's like a new practice. I mean, relatively new from the 100 years ago, but the story of this community, as they describe it, is far more ancient. They saying that they are part of really ancient history of the 10 tribes that, I mean, were put out from Israel, and they got to India. So I mean, they don't see themselves as like Judaism, something that they learned for, I don't know, for the last 100 years.
Yeah, exactly. So I give a short background about the myth of the 10 tribes. Maybe not all of the audience know it. So basically, according to the Bible, there were 12 tribes of the sons of Israel, the Jews. And around 2,500 years ago, a few of them were exiled by Assyrian kingdom towards the east. And from that time and onwards, there's only two tribes that remained in part as part of the Jewish people. But according to some traditional commentary, these 10 tribes will come back before the time of the redemption, and still it remained in the memory of the Jews. And back to the story of this Jewish community in Manipur in the area. So basically, in the tribe of the Kuki and the Mizo and the Chin people, they had special customs. Part of them were quite similar to biblical customs. They were called even Menashia or Menasia. And when actually they got introduced again to the Bible by the missionaries, so they read about one of the 10 lost tribes that were called Menashe or Menaseh, and it rings a bell in their head, and they assume that there are the descendants of that lost tribe. and therefore they have different kind of customs and have very, very special stories. I can't get into all this
Of
story. I did
course.
an investigation about it. But basically, when the rabbis, authorities of Israel came there, the chief rabbi of Israel came there in 2014, Rabbi Shlomo Amar. So he went into this custom and this text and this history, and he recognized them as descendants of Israeli people, and therefore they're allowed to come to Israel according to the law of return or government decisions, and actually become part of the Jewish and Israeli society. So there's two points where you could start this story. You could start with Melat Shola around 100 years ago, or you could start it within the Bible, and combining these two narratives together, you could get the full picture.
Yes, it's a bit of, one more point which is interesting is that they are part of from the Kukis, which are originated, or I don't know, part of Myanmar and Burma, which I mean usually like Jewish community were really separated from other communities, like you've seen in Ethiopia and in other places where there were doubts about the roots of the people, if they are Jews or not. They were separated from the other community, and here they are like part of the Kukis, which is a bit surprising. I don't know. I'm saying it without I'm saying it without criticism. I'm saying it like I mean I'm really asking about that.
It's a very surprising story. Another fact that's quite surprising is that when I question Kuki people that are not necessarily Jewish, as I told, most of them follow Christianity today, and I ask them, do you believe in that myth that you're descendants of part of the 10 tribes? And they agreed completely. Of course, not everyone, it's a personal opinion, but a lot of them mentioned that. And then I asked them, so why aren't you immigrating to Israel or practicing Judaism? Why are you sticking to the belief in Jesus Christ and Christianity and going to church? So they said that they feel it's enough. Yeah, they're part of the 10 tribes, but they're not necessarily need to do anything practical in their life. As an Israeli, I was really welcomed there by the Kukti population. They saw me as some kind of far sibling. But besides that, they're living their regular life. And only a small portion, I think maybe 1% of the population of the Kukti actually said that, okay, so if this tradition is right, so yeah, therefore we need to reunite with our brotherhood in Israel and go
That's
and
right.
immigrate and go and
Yes.
complete this biblical amazing story.
Okay. It's interesting. So this is the Jewish point, because in Israel there were a few articles about the violence that the Jewish community is suffering, which is not specific for Jewish. It's not like, I don't think it's ethnic, like against Jewish. It's like part of the ethnic conflict as a whole between the Kuki and the Métis. That okay. So for conclusion, how do you see like the end of the conflict? Because again, I'm remembering in one story that you told me when we talked before, that like you've been in a village in Nagaland, which is half of it is under India ruling and half of it is under Myanmar ruling, and they're like it's not clear where the border is, and I'm thinking to myself, maybe it's like comfortable for the center that the conflict will not solve, because they cannot solve it. It's really too complicated to solve it.
Exactly. I don't think that international borders are going to be changed. I don't think that there's going to be independence to any state in the Northeast. All the so-called national groups there are not going to succeed, at least not in this reality. But as we know, we both live in the Middle East, and we see that conflicts not only between Israelis and Palestinians, but between Sunni and Shia, and just name it, so many conflicts that are right now going in the Middle East. And I think the idea is not to find the ultimate solution and find a way to get peace and resolve all problems in 2 or 3 years. It's not going to happen. But still, building trust between communities, trying to build a country, fighting against violence. I saw that now, actually, the forces there are looking for all the weapons that were looted from army camps or smuggled through the border. And I think it's the right actions. And I think that the only solution is to talk about the long terms, is talk about maybe peace between in the next 3 or 4 generations. I hope that maybe in 50, 100 years we could talk about peace. And when we get these perspectives of working in the long term, I think it becomes much more practical than talking about short-term solutions.
Yes, I agree. I mean, beside it, from a personal point of view, as you mentioned, I think that, as you said, at least from the description of that village, that it's not even practical to solve it, because like when you have like one village which is like under two different state. I mean, it's not practical even to I don't know, to say when how you solve it. And you mentioned also that there is like also a drug shipment between the two part of the village, and also like really criminal activity. So maybe even I don't know, people don't want it to be like, I don't know, to be decided. How it going to be? I mean, maybe they are comfortable with that smug, the situation.
Yeah, it's very complicated, and as I mentioned, it's unique when you compare it to other parts of India. But still, we know that India, at least modern India, is known as a tolerant statehood. I mean, we do see different kinds of, even the idea of allowing part of the Raj after independence still having their palaces and still having their own. It shows about a lot of flexibility when it gets to the way how different communities rule
Yes,
themselves. And
definitely.
I think that this sense of flexibility could be an advantage for this region. I think still the center needs to put red lines. If there is some kind of criminal activities, smuggling of drugs or anything like that, of course, it's something that the states need, the country needs to stop. But on the other hand, if there is some kind of things that don't affect anyone, so maybe the government doesn't need to manage that area as it manages Delhi or Bangalore or any other center area in India. And basically, I think that a lot of development needs to be done. I think that once people don't have economic options, don't have educational options, so the violence is much more, the potential for violence is much higher. And I think like the constructing of the railway or the roads and it's happening right now in Manipur, and I don't know, allowing better trade routes to Myanmar. It's basically walking in the right direction.
Yes, I like your phrase that India has a great tolerance for all kind of ideas and things and practice, and also has a lot of flexibility. And I hope that this flexibility and tolerance may give peace for that area. So thank you. It was really pleasure to talk with you and to hear from your knowledge, and I hope that also our audience would like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I hope that next time we could talk about the nature of Manipur and amazing things to see there and less about violence. But yeah, we all hope to more quieter and peaceful days.
Totally, I totally agree with you. Thank you, Matanel. Thank you for your time. Bye.